Very proud. Thank you, guys. Good morning. Good morning. My name is Ellen Vorenkamp, and it is my pleasure to... It's my pleasure to welcome you to the 66th Annual Michigan School Testing Conference. This is our 66th year, and we're really excited that you're here with us. We've got a great program of sessions and clinics and keynotes, and again, just thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like you to take just a moment and turn to a table mate, and if you don't know them, introduce yourselves. Just say good morning. And maybe share one thing that you're really looking forward to in the next 2 days. So just take a minute, greet each other, say good morning, introduce yourselves, and what are you looking forward to in the next day or two? Thank you. All right, we're going to do one more activity before I introduce Dr. Stephen Sneed, who's going to introduce our keynoter. You'll note on your tables you have some dots. What we'd like you to do is grab a sheet of dots, and you may have to share with a friend. But if you are brand new to the conference, put a red dot on your badge. If you have been to the conference more than 10 times, and there are some of us in here who have, put a green dot on your name badge. Take and put a yellow dot on your badge if you are on the planning committee and or one of our presenters throughout yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So I'll give you a minute to do those three things. Red dot if you're brand new, green dot if you've attended 10 or more, yellow dot if you are a presenter or you are part of our planning committee. And then what I'm going to ask you to do is take a sheet of the blue dots with you after we're done this morning and give them away to a colleague who is going to make an impact on you over the next 2 days. And let them put them on their name tags as you gift them to them for something that they've done that's made an impact on you over the next couple of days. So make sure you take one of those strips of blue with you. And you can take as many as you want, as long as there's enough for everybody at the table. All right, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Stephen Sneed, who's going to introduce our keynote.
All right. All right, good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Hey, up here.
Look at me.
I'm so thrilled to welcome our morning speaker. It'll be quite a treat. And I'm going to read a very pithy bio on her, but a little short little story. Those of you who know me, like, oh, yeah, Stephen's going to give a story, right? It's me. Raise your hand if you have ever attended the American Education Research Association Conference. Anybody ever go to AERA? Oh, look at y'all. All right. Yes, I love it. So for me, back in 2023, when I believe Rich Milner was the president of AER at the time, speaking to a crowd of thousands of the nation's educators, researchers, and practitioners, in his speech, he talked about being of consequence, being a researcher of consequence, so that your work wouldn't be in service of your own resume, but that your work would be in service of being real consequence to people and the improvement of their lives through the power of research in our practice. And that message really, really stuck with me, like being of consequence. And so I'm delighted to bring Dr. Carla Evans to the stage, because when I think about scholars and researchers who have been consequential in their research and in their practice, I think of Carla, because her work is helping to shift our understanding and our mindset of what really great practice can do for teaching and learning within the realm of assessment. Dr. Carla Evans is an associate director at the National Center for the Improvement of Educational Assessment, otherwise known as the Center for Assessment. Carla supports states in designing and implementing assessment and accountability reforms. Her work includes leading statewide assessment system reviews, assessment literacy initiatives, balanced assessment systems, and performance assessment design and implementation activities. Carla also supports states with accountability design and reforms, including working with task forces to define and operationalize values into the accountability system design and implementation. Carla recently published two books, I have them both, Understanding Instructionally Useful Assessment, which she co-wrote with Scott Marion, and a co-edited volume with Catherine Taylor, Culturally Responsive Assessment in Classrooms and Large-Scale Context Theory, Research, and Practice. Carla has published numerous articles in peer-reviewed journals and regularly presents her research at national education research conferences like AERA. Carla also serves as an adjunct professor of education at the University of New Hampshire. Carla began her career as an elementary classroom teacher for almost a decade. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome her to the stage, the one, the only, Dr. Carla Evans.
Stephen does such a nice introduction, so thank you so much for that. I'm delighted to be here with you today and to talk a little bit about something that I'm very passionate about, obviously. I wrote a book about it, which takes a little bit of grit, and when you get into it after so many months, you think, do I really still care about this? And for me, the answer was a resounding yes. Because as Stephen said, I started out as a classroom teacher, and as I work now in states and do some work with districts and some with teachers, this resounding over-testing concern about what we're doing to our students and this question about what does it mean that an assessment informs instruction continues to percolate up. So it's something that I still am very passionate about, and I hope that as we talk today, that it's something that will shape how you think about conversations you have with teachers, because how many of you in this room are teachers? Okay, some. How many of you are district or school leaders? Okay, so definitely more. That's what I was told, much more leaders here at the conference, but some teachers. And so as leaders, you're having conversations with teachers where you're, discussing assessment and teaching and learning. And so I'm hoping that as we're talking about what does it take for an assessment to actually directly inform instruction, that it might shape some of those conversations or at least give you something to think about. This presentation is accessible from the QR code. I'll share this slide again at the end, so if you don't get the QR code or the tiny URL, I think it's also in the conference materials. But it's based on this book that Scott and I wrote. And the background for that book and the motivation for us, as I already sort of alluded to, is just our coming across educators in state after state after state. That's leaders. That's teachers who are just overwhelmed with this snowstorm, this blizzard. Pretty apropos here for living in Michigan. I'm in New Hampshire. We got plenty of snow. Caught in this snowstorm of assessment data that's masquerading as information. And there's seats up here. If you guys in the back want to come sit, feel free. You're not going to bother me. We have lots and lots of data. The question is that really information? And part of that is it seems to just roll off of our tongue. Well, of course this test can be used to inform instruction. If you're a child of the 80s like I was, right, this Princess Bride, like you keep using that word or phrase, and I'm not sure you know what that means. Or if every assessment known to mankind can inform instruction, then I don't think we really understand that every assessment is typically designed to fulfill one purpose well. So if it's serving a monitoring function, an evaluation function, it's not also typically going to be able to directly inform instruction. And so that's the heart and the soul of our motivation for writing this, is to start to think about, well, why is that? What is it about the design of the assessment, the way it's implemented, that we could know from the outset the likelihood this is going to actually directly inform instruction or not? Let's not give it to the students. Make teachers give it to students, and then be surprised, oh my goodness, you couldn't do something with this data except pass it along your desk to the next person in line. You know, it's the school superintendent who's like, that's really interesting results. Pass it along to my principals. Principals are like, oh, that's super interesting results. Pass it along to my teachers or instructional coaches, expecting somebody down the line to then be like, eureka, now I know what to do with all of this data. We are data rich, but information and insight poor. So why? Well, we got a lot of data. We got state assessment data, interim data, end of unit classroom data, quizzes, in the moment data. We got all of it. And we know teachers are being told, and so this talk today really does focus on the teacher. What's the stories and the messages being communicated to teachers? And as leaders, you are a key part in that communication stream, or as teachers, to have agency to understand, why do I sometimes wonder, what do I do with this information? When I'm being told, do something instructionally useful with all of this information. So I'm hoping I'm going to take some things off your plate today and say, maybe it's not to directly inform instruction. It might serve a different purpose in the system. Here's a true example of sort of this, what this leads to in our educational system. When we think every assessment can inform instruction, what ends up happening is we just keep layering assessments on. So this was from an assessment system review that we did in the state of Texas. This was one district. It's a true example. We did focal grades, 1, 4, 7, and 9, and after a process of looking at all of the assessments students were taking over the course of the year. This does not include formative assessment processes, practices. This is just district-required assessments, school-required assessments, and end-of-unit classroom assessments, quizzes, those kinds of things. So notice grade 1. A grade 1 student is taking 78 assessments over the course of the year, which equates to about 8 days of instructional time. And as they get older, welcome to school, kids. This is going to be so much fun. I wonder why our students don't seem so engaged or motivated. By grade 9, we have 200 assessments that they're experiencing over the course of a year. This is across the 4 core content areas, by the way. 24 days of instruction. When you're stopping and assessing, you're not instructing. These aren't formative assessment, formative instructional opportunities. This is, have they learned what we taught them kinds of moments. This was one of the reflections from one of the groups. We found that students completed a total of 28 assessments over the course of just 26 days. This was actually at the beginning of the year, which is where we see a lot of testing happening, right? This intense schedule highlights the need, they said, to reevaluate the frequency and duration of assessments to ensure they support rather than overwhelm student learning. So we're doing a lot of assessing. Do we see a lot of rise in student achievement? We definitely know how to assess, but is that leading to any student achievement gains? Right? Assessment is an outcome measure. It's not the intervention. And sometimes I think when we confuse that, and that term, this test can be used to inform instruction, makes us think that the test can be the intervention, but it's not. We're just weighing the pig, right? We just keep weighing it, getting on the scale and being like, gosh, something's not changing here. Let's just weigh ourselves 5 minutes later. Did something else change? I didn't change my diet. I didn't change my exercise. I didn't change anything. Let me just get on that scale again and see if it changed. Like, it just doesn't make sense if we stop and think about it for a moment. Does this sound familiar to you? Is this resonate with what you're seeing in schools in your context. I see some of you shaking your heads, right? This data-rich but information and insight poor. So these are my four arguments today and what we're going to walk through, and then I have a follow-up session after if you want to ask more questions, talk about things that are happening in your context. We all obviously want assessments to be useful. Why else would we be giving them, right? But not all assessments are or can be instructionally useful. Doesn't make them useless, but we have to think about what are other important uses in schools. And I think after No Child Left Behind and that whole reform of test-based accountability, we have forgotten other uses of assessment in school. Before No Child Left Behind, this real strong stream of program evaluation, using assessment, leaders using assessment to say, is our curriculum working? Do we have enough teachers and resources and support staff to support this cohort of students or that cohort of students? Using it at a program evaluation level or to identify students who need more supports or interventions, that's different, a different use case than saying we're going to directly change instruction. And that's also a different and other important users. We go right to teachers. We like to do that. I don't know why that is, but it's like everything teachers should be able to do everything with every assessment. But some assessments aren't designed for teachers. And I think that that's a message I hope you take away, is what assessments are really for teachers and what are for other users in the system who also need information and of a different variety. They need aggregate information. They can look across classrooms. I don't want to like pick up every student's end of unit test and look at that. I don't have time as a leader to do that. I need to see aggregate data to help me to understand patterns and trends in my school, in my district, in my state. And that's a very different user and use case. And then let's be clear which assessments can be instructionally useful and how that's tied to their design and implementation features. And that's really was the heart of this book, was Scott and I getting together and saying, well, what would be those design and implementation features we could look at before we gave it to a student and predict the likelihood it's going to be instructionally useful? And that's what we'll talk about here today. So first I'll define instructionally useful. I've been using that term a lot. I haven't even defined it yet. Then explain those features that I just talked about, and then some actionable next steps if you are a district or school leader and you want to think about, well, what might be some take-home messages or action steps if you're so interested. And again, another plug for the breakout session after. So when we went to write the book, one of the things we realized is that no one had defined the term. There's some related terms like instructional sensitivity, but no one had actually defined what does it mean for an assessment, other than if you think about like assessment for learning, right? We know that there's characteristics and features of those processes that take place, but we were like, great, this is our opportunity then to write a really long-winded sentence that looking back, we're like, maybe we could have shortened this a little, but it's in print and it is what it is. So, I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to break it down and discuss what it means and why we chose certain words specifically. An instructionally useful assessment provides substantive insights. You can see that's bolded, and it's bolded because that's sort of the first line of defense here. Is this a substantive insight about what? About student learning strengths and needs relative to specific learning targets. And that's, again, bolded because it's not really helpful to me as a classroom teacher to get information about my students' progress over the entire year of standards. What do I do with that instructionally? Obviously, it's a signal, like red flag, this student needs more attention, or green flag or yellow flag, but it doesn't. I need it to be more specific than that to give me insight to know what is going on and what could I do differently tomorrow or within a very short amount of time to change that student's learning trajectory. I need it to be more specific and I need it to be insightful. And then that it can positively influence the interactions among the teacher, the student, and the content. And we chose that, which I know makes this very long, because that idea comes from Richard Elmore, who is a professor at Harvard, who wrote about the instructional core. And his basic argument was this. There are three things that you can do to change student achievement at scale. You can raise the level of content that students are taught. You can increase the skill and knowledge that teachers bring to the teaching of that content, so pedagogical content knowledge and expertise. You can increase the level of students' active learning of the content, their engagement. Anything else you do outside of this instructional core may be important, but it's not actually changing student learning. So we know that there's outside influences that happen. There are grading policies in schools and districts that can really make a mess of what's going on in the classroom. That was actually what was going on in that district, is they were a very large district, 100,000 students, and they had crazy grading policies, so much so that teachers were just grading everything, and therefore assessing everything. We know that there's accountability pressure. In some states, teachers are evaluated on student test scores. I recognize there's a lot of mediating factors that happen outside of the classroom, but if you want to talk about what does actually change your learning, it has to be something related to teacher-student and content interactions. And so that's another sort of line of defense. If you're thinking about getting assessment or giving it or getting assessment results back, is it actually informing, giving insight to change that dynamic in any way, any of those relationships? We recognize that it's the Olympic season. I couldn't think of a better analogy with the Winter Olympics, so you get a summer one. We recognize that this is a high bar in terms of how we're defining instructionally useful assessment, and we did it on purpose. For two reasons. One is that strong claims require strong evidence. So you will see marketing claims from every commercial interim assessment provider, ed tech company, and they will be making very strong claims about what their products and services can do related to informing instruction. That's a claim. We're scientific people. I need some evidence that can back up the fact that you're making those claims. And so if we're gonna claim that this test can inform instruction, I want some evidence that that could be true. Also, from my perspective, the blame game on teachers of just like, you're not smart enough apparently to take this student report, this class roster report, and do something with it instructionally. Like, you must be the stupidest person alive. And that was the message communicated to me. I started teaching in 2000, which was, you know, right as No Child Left Behind came in. So I had a couple years of teaching. It was like bliss. We had state testing, but we didn't have the whole commercial infrastructure around commercial interim assessments. And so when that came to be, then it was like, here's my principal handing me my report. Carla, go do something instructionally useful with this. Like, do something with it, because they didn't know what to do, right? So it's like, it got passed along from the superintendent. They were like, oh, that's interesting. Passed along from the principal. And I was like, I must be the stupidest person alive, because I'm not sure what to do. I didn't even teach this yet. What am I supposed to do with this information? How do I make sense of this number? Now, obviously, it's a signal to me. Hey, this student seems way below grade level. I don't know how they determined that, but that was a signal to me like, hey, pay attention. I think I kind of already knew that, just throwing it out there, because I had them in my class, and I was already like, hey, little concerned here. But, you know, great. A second measure to really, you know, bolster that. But I think we've gotten into this blame game with teachers of, like, do something instructionally useful with every piece of information. And I don't think that that's helping the professionalism of educators. And I think it's demoralizing, and it creates this pressure that then teachers don't know what to do with it. So let me talk about these in a little bit more detail. So this is from Renaissance's website. I could have chosen from NWE Map, iReady Diagnostic, fill in the blank. So I'm not picking on Renaissance Star at all. My kids take Star. But this is what they say on their website. STAR assessments support all pre-K to 12 students' learning journeys with assessments designed to drive instruction. The assessment is intended to drive instruction, drive it, and accelerate reading and math growth. Accelerate. The assessment is going to accelerate math and reading growth. If we just stop for a second, we're like, how would the assessment that's measuring where they are accelerate their math and reading growth? How would we want it to drive instruction? Do we want this multiple choice test to drive the kinds of teaching and learning experiences we want? You just take a second, right? You're like, I'm not sure about that. And I could literally take you to every other commercial product and you will find the same claims. The problem is there's no evidence that even when teachers try to do that, that it works. So this is from an EdWeek series by Heather Hill and Susanna Loeb. In our book, we have plenty of other research from other places. But the question they asked in this EdWeek article was, what activity is done by most teachers in the United States but has almost no evidence of effectiveness in raising student test scores? Their answer, analyzing student assessment data. Data digs, data walls, database decision making, data, data, data. Right? You've all heard it, you've all done it. I've heard it, I've done it. And teachers, like, we're very compliant. I mean, I think that's, you know, we get in, we're like, okay, we're like gonna dig into this data. Okay, I'm not, what is that data telling me? So their suggestion was, the research in this area suggests that district and school leaders should rethink their use of state and interim assessments as the focus of teacher collaboration. So we think about PLCs, we think about like, yeah, get all your test score data and go look at it together. Okay, why are we doing that? What's the purpose? So again, I can get a signal from that, but it doesn't tell me anything more, and I'll give more specific examples later. It has a different purpose in the system. So I don't wanna like, you know, bash every state in interim assessment. I got, you know, Andy here from the Michigan Department of Ed. But it has a different purpose. It has a different user. Again, I'm focusing here on teachers and informing instruction. But the fact remains that having teachers themselves examine test score data has yet to be proven productive, even after many trials of such programs. And I'll talk a little bit later about even when you have teachers go to item and standard level reports, I'll talk about the research on why that's ineffective and not actually helping teachers to inform instruction. And as I already said, why are we blaming teachers, right? You just don't have enough assessment literacy, teacher, pull it together and do something instructionally useful with this. So as I just mentioned, these sort of standard or item level reports. So this is one way that interim assessment companies in particular are trying to make the data more useful. So they say, okay, let me give you an item level report. So every item on this test, I'll tell you, for every student on your roster, did they get it right or did they get it wrong? Or partially correct. This one is like right, wrong, partial. The assumption, or you can have it by standard, that learning is dependent on reteaching specific items or standards. There's a couple issues with this, and I'll talk about some of the research in a second. One is that when you do that, the first thing teachers do, research shows, is they reteach that item because they don't realize that that item is chosen from the massive item bank. It's from a universe of items that's meant to represent learning. But they don't know what to do, so they put up that item, they drill and kill it with their kids, and they're like, solved. Problem is, the next assessment, they get a different item that doesn't look the same, and then they don't get it right. And the teacher's really demoralized, like, what did I do wrong? Right? In addition, this is what Lori Shepherd refers to as the 1,000 mini lesson problem. Over the course of a year, it would take 1,000 mini lessons to respond item by item and student by student to all of the missed items on interim assessments. And resulting lessons would be incoherent. I think these are the biggest things in what I'm going to linger on here in a minute, and decontextualized for the students, as well as impractical for the teacher. The truth is that teachers do not have time to go back and reteach lessons after the fact for all of the topics missed on interim assessments without jeopardizing the curriculum for the next months of the school year. So this notion of time, but also incoherent and decontextualized. One of the things that I struggled with when I was given these item and standard level reports was, okay, I'm teaching a unit right now on fractions. So if I dig down into this item level report or standard level report and pull out the standards of the items on fractions, I can see which students got them right or wrong, but I don't know why they got them right or wrong. So I actually don't know what they're missing. I don't know what to teach differently. I have to reassess, love that, in order to better understand. So that's sort of this misnomer, is it's decontextualized. I had to associate those items and standards with my curriculum, put it back in my curriculum scope and sequence. And some teachers don't do that, by the way. They don't try to fit it back in. They just start doing this bird, squirrel, plane. They just literally, this is what the research shows, will just reteach the standards of the item, some of which they haven't even been taught yet, in this decontextualized fashion. Students don't learn like that. I don't learn like that, right? I learn by having my teacher hopefully put together a coherent scope and sequence of learning. So if we're talking about fractions, we're talking about fractions. It's not like multi-digit multiplication, ratios and proportions, like all in one thing. It just doesn't make sense. Okay, my soapbox. We're back. So the key thing that I'm trying to communicate here is that there are certain ways that we can predict what is going to help a teacher. And that if everything can be instructionally useful, then nothing is really instructionally useful. So let's get into these features. In the book, we talk about 10 assessment design and implementation features. I'm going to talk about the top 7 today, because those are the ones that I really think are the most important and easy to spot in any assessment. So think of these like the dial on your radio in the car. They are along a continuum. They exist along a continuum. You can turn the volume up, you can turn the volume down, and some of them tend to cluster together, which you'll see in a second as I talk about them. So look at number 1 with me, cognitive complexity and associated item type. It's just a fancy way of thinking about the continuum like this. We know on an assessment there are certain kinds of item types. Selected response, right? Multiple choice. The response is there, the students just need to select it. Then you have constructed response. The students are constructing something, it's typically short. It might be they're solving a math problem, it might be that they're writing a couple sentences, but it's something that they're constructing. Then you have things like performance tasks. You might have essays. Things that are requiring more cognitive complexity. So it's associated because when you're just selecting a response, it typically is getting at DOK 1 or 2. Are you guys familiar with DOK 1? And 2, Bloom's taxonomy, sort of lower level thinking. Fact, recall, procedural knowledge, and skill. As you move over in the continuum, you tend to see, not always, by the way, you can see very poorly written performance tasks. It'll say performance task on the top, and then you're like, what are students applying, right? Is this applying knowledge and skill to a new or novel context? So well-written performance tasks are going to elicit strategic and analytical thinking. Synthesis, evaluation, higher order thinking skills. DOK 3, if it's an extended task, it could get into 4. So if you think about what is going to be instructionally useful, we'll get to that in a minute. What's the relationship here between these? Well, the standards represent all of those things, DOK levels. There are standards in math in every content area. You can see I'm a math person because I go right there. You need to be able to add and subtract fluently within 20. Within 100. Like, there are very procedural skill and fluency. There's conceptual understanding and there's application standards. So we need to have a plethora of item types in order for teachers to be able to get what they need to understand what students need next. Coherence with the enacted curriculum. We have assessments that are completely curriculum agnostic and designed that way intentionally. Curriculum agnostic, meaning you can use any curriculum you want, and that shouldn't be a barrier to students being able to perform well on it. State assessments are designed like that because states don't control curriculum. Most commercial interim assessment products are designed like that because they don't control, they don't know what curriculum the district is using. They don't control that. So it's intentionally designed to represent the standards, but to be agnostic to the curriculum, the way that it's presented, anything, language used, all of that. On the other end of the continuum, you have curriculum-specific assessments. These are the ones that are curriculum embedded. They might use the same kinds of frameworks and language and things that students are more familiar with. And you have everything in between. If teachers need to make sense of this for instruction, it's really difficult to do that if it's curriculum agnostic, because they don't know how to fit it back into their curriculum scope and sequence. So the tighter woven it is and curriculum specific, the easier it is for them to be able to make sense of it and put it, that information back into instruction. The breadth of content standards and resulting grain size of results, number three. So you can imagine assessments that are over the full year of content standards, all grade five ELA. They're surveying across that. State assessments do that because that's their monitoring function. They're making sure teachers are teaching all of those standards. Commercial interim products mostly are of that variety. They're the entire year of standards. Each time you are giving it, you are giving the entire year of standards, end of year expectations, even though students haven't been taught it. On the other hand, you have one standard, one part of a standard, a cluster of standards, something that's smaller. And as a result, the information you get back, that grain size of results, if you're giving an entire year of standards, then you're gonna get an achievement level, a scale score, because it's trying to summarize for you student performance relative to that entire year of standards. On the other hand, if you're just having one standard or one part of a standard, it's gonna be very specific information. It doesn't even need to be a number. It could just be looking at the student work. This relates then to number four, the type of results. So on the one hand, qualitative results allow, are just being able to look at the student work or a description of the work to see what they did and why they did it, to be able to have visibility and observe in some form or fashion what is it that the student was thinking. On the other hand, when you have just quantitative results, the sort of data, 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 that is much more difficult for a teacher to make sense of. If I could tell you how to raise a scale score by 10 points, I'd be a millionaire. And I work in large scale assessment and design testing scales. It is not content referenced. Some cases it's norm referenced for some of your commercial interim products. In some cases it's criterion referenced, criterion to a standard. But it is not something that I could say, oh, 10 points. Okay, how do I raise whoever, Jennifer's scaled score by 10 points? I don't know. It's meaningless. So that's the problem, is it doesn't have meaning in and of itself when you just have these quantitative numbers. Timing of results. So how is the teacher getting the information? Moment by moment, day by day, monthly, yearly. This is one that's sort of misunderstood, and what's sort of leading to the through-year assessment movement in the United States is people just think, well, if I give them back this information more frequently, so let me give the state test now 3 times a year, because that is going to be more informational. If you're Montana, I'll give 12 math testlets over the course of the year, and I'll give 8 to 10 ELA testlets, because if I do these little testlets that are smaller in scope and I just do it more frequently, that's going to be more instructionally useful. The problem is, when you give teachers back a quantitative result, you just do it more frequently. 10, 20, 12, 15, 18. Do you feel like you're more informed now? So it's a necessary but insufficient condition. Obviously, teachers need information frequently, but it's the type of information has to be bundled with that, or it's meaningless. So sort of that through year assessment problem is they just think, oh, I just, you know, that's the problem. We just do end of year state testing. Now we just need to do it more frequently. Well, unless you change the whole design of the test, you're not really helping teachers. administration and scoring conditions. So is the teacher able to see the test items and how students responded, or is it completely blind to them because it's under test security protocols? State tests are under test security protocols for reasons. Test items are very expensive to develop. Many states don't even release any test items because of that reason. Commercial interim products are sometimes in between. You might be able to see some items, but sometimes you don't see any items and you don't see how students responded. That's very different than being able to see the student work. And obviously you can infer from there what's more instructionally useful. Allowable student responses. So is the students just selecting a response or are they writing something? Because when they just select a response, I don't know why they selected it. Dylan Williams often quips, he's an author of Formative Assessment. Many of you, I see some of you shaking your head. Dylan Williams is very famous. But one of his anecdotes that he likes to do on his rounds of speaking is you can make any multiple choice item useful for instruction if you just have the students do the work on the side. Take the item, have them fill it out, and then do their work on the side. Why? Because then the teacher knows what was asked and what the student selected, and they can look at the work to figure out why or ask the student to explain why. And then I'm going to skip over 8, 9, and 10. Feel free to ask me about it in the Q&A if you want more. So just putting all that together, the likelihood that an assessment is going to be instructionally useful is if the assessment fosters a range of thinking. So it's not just all fact recall and procedural knowledge and skills, not just all multiple choice. There's multiple choice, constructed response, performance tasks, obviously aligned with the standards you're trying to gather information about. Tied closely to the enacted curriculum, focus on one standard or a small number of related standards. Reveal students' thinking, provide those qualitative insights, substantive insights, if you will, to teachers. They're timely, administered so that teachers know what students are responding to and how they respond, and full of open-ended items so that students' thinking is made visible. So you could predict ahead of time, let's look at the assessment. Let's look at how it's implemented. Not just how it's designed, but how it's also implemented in practice, and know pretty well, obviously there's mediating factors like accountability, and I just read an article on the plane here. I don't want to get too far off track, but it was super interesting. It was some researchers who did a meta-synthesis internationally and nationally about the effects of not just high-stakes accountability, but low-stakes accountability on curriculum practices, instructional practices, students, teachers, the professionalism of teachers, and their own feelings of burnout. And it's fascinating, meta-synthesis of any time you layer accountability, low-stakes accountability, not just high stakes, it has potential to have really negative effects on even the best assessments that we might design. So something to keep in mind. Let me give you an example to sort of lower the inference here of what I mean about a substantive insight and why your teachers, or if you're a teacher in the room, might feel frustrated by some of the assessment information and reports that you get back. When I talk about substantive insights, this is the formative assessment process or one heuristic or framework for that on the right-hand side. Where's the learner going? Where's the learner now? And how do I get from here to there? This is a very common one. I think it's actually Dylan's framework. So when we're at the where's the learner now, that's where the teacher is trying to figure it out, right? Like, where are they right now? I hope I know where they're going, but I can't decide how to get from here to there until I know where they're at. Well, the assessment should be able to help the teacher ask and answer, what do I notice in the student work? How does the student work relate to a typical progression of learning? That requires pedagogical content knowledge, by the way. That's where that part of the instructional core comes in. And what could I do next instructionally for the whole class, small groups, or for individuals? That's the professionalism of teaching, right? The art and science is knowing, well, what do I do now with this information? How do I act upon it in a way that's going to be useful? So here's one item. Hassan played tag for 25 minutes, then played basketball for 28 minutes. How many minutes did Hassan play altogether? This is a very common, you could see this on any assessment. Notice that there's three pieces of student work. So it's not selected response, you see the work. You could have had the selected response. They all got the answer right, 53. But what I want you to notice from a teaching and learning perspective is that they are each at very, very different places on an additive reasoning learning progression. The first student started at 1 and counted to 53, literally one by one, concrete, right? 1 all the way. Didn't start at 28 and counted on. So I'm thinking as a teacher, that's the next instructional move for this student and students like them. I'm not going to jump to the traditional algorithm. They're still literally counting 1 to 53. So I'm going to start with counting on. I'm going to start then teaching skip counting. I'm going to make instructional moves that make sense based on a progression of learning that's typical. The student in the middle, they're starting to get to representational, base 10 rods and blocks. Notice they go 10, 20, 30, 40. They're skip counting. Then they're counting each block. So what I do with this student is going to be to move them to something that is less representational, that is the numbers themselves. Like, keep representing it, but now let's move a little bit to some numbers that are very abstract. Then I have the 25 plus 28 with the number bonds. They're like, oh, well, 28, 25, I could represent and show that 28 is 25 and 3, and I can add these together. They're still not using the traditional algorithm, by the way. But you can see their strong number sense. They understand how the numbers themselves represent real values. So I say all this because when you think about any type of progression, again, I'm a math person, so I always go to like math progressions. This is the one by OGAP. They have 4 or 5 different progressions for additive reasoning, multiplicative, fractional. They're all free, by the way. Ratios and proportional reasoning, base 10. And they show how students progress. That's what is so necessary from an assessment if I want to do something instructionally useful with it. I have to understand why. Why did you get 53? Because if I don't know why, then I don't know what's next. Here's an example that could provide program evaluation insights. That's really important. Or identify a student who needs additional support, intervention, or enrichment. Look familiar? You have a high-quality assessment that's given to every student, grades 3 to 8, once in high school, at the end of every school year. It's highly reliable, and it gives you a great picture of students who need extra support, cohorts of students who need extra support, schools who need extra support. And what it tells you from any individual student report are typically 3 pieces of information: achievement level, scaled score, and some sort of subcategory performance. It's called different things in different states. In Michigan, it's called claims. So you see reading, writing, listening, research, and you can see how the student does on each of those general categories of performance. So this would help if I aggregate this. If I'm a school leader, I'm looking across classrooms, or if I'm a district leader, I'm looking across schools. This helps me to give me insight into what are the patterns and trends happening. And I can look at this data and I get a sense of a full year of standards. So end of year expectations and what do we need to do differently? It doesn't tell me what to do differently. So if I look at aggregate reports, it's going to send me a signal. Hey, red flag with this group of students, red flag with this student, red flag within this school. But I still don't know why. Is it because their teachers don't have curriculum? Is it because students don't feel safe in school? Like, I have literally no idea why. So it requires follow-up investigation, but it's very useful information. And similarly, you get this kind of information from commercial interims. You get scaled scores, you get achievement levels. Some have, like, this is the star, give you student growth percentiles. Damien at my organization created those to give you a sense of what's this student typical progress with their academic peers. What's their growth in relation to their academic peers? So are they making sufficient growth? And you can see the trends here. You can see the subcategory performance below. You're getting the same kind of information on your state test, which then you might want to pause and ask, okay, great, I'm getting this information now more frequently. Many districts give it fall, winter, spring. I'm also giving the state test in the spring. My kids' school, they take the state test, and then the next week they take STAR. I'm always like, you know, Talk me off that soapbox. So like, great, okay, you're giving it. What are you doing with this information? And that's what we're gonna transition with. Like, if you're giving these assessments and you're a leader, now I'm talking to you. What are you doing with this information? Because I've already pleaded with you, please don't make teachers do something with it instructionally useful. So what are you doing with it? Is it coming at the right time for you to make a different decision? If not, why are you doing it, would be the question. I have seen really great examples of districts using commercial interim assessments for really good purposes in their districts. And I have seen others who are like, we don't know why we're doing it, but we're doing it, our school board wants it, we report it every time we do it, thank you very much. And you will pry this out of my cold, dead hands. Here's my key point, coming back to a lighter note. There is a difference between the data that teachers can interpret and use for instructional purposes and data that others within the educational system can interpret and use for evaluative or monitoring purposes. And this is why we have different tests for different purposes and uses, which we seem to very easily forget when we start to just give a lot of assessments. So, in other words, assessments aren't Swiss Army knives. If it does a nice job giving aggregate information to a leader, it's likely also not going to give you information as a teacher for informing instruction. So I'm doing a little sidebar here on balanced assessment systems because I think this is the logical next step. How many of you have heard the term balanced assessment systems? Oh my gosh, I love the state of Michigan. So I was in a room in Louisiana 2 years ago. Double the number of people. Ask them, how many of you have ever heard the term balanced assessment systems? Literally not one person raised their hand. And I was like, comprehensive assessment systems. Coherent assessment systems. Sensible assessment systems. I was like, okay, wow. Assessment systems at all? No. No. So, yeah, right. They knew the word systems, but that was about it. So why I bring this up is because this notion of assessments serving different purposes and uses and users was at the heart of this recently released volume called Reimagining Balanced Assessment Systems. So Scott, my co-author, was one of the editors on that with Jim Pellegrino and Amy Berman. I wrote a chapter in that volume. The idea of balanced assessment systems came from Knowing What Students Know, which was a publication in 2001. 25 years went on, and part of what happened was we had No Child Left Behind, we had other federal policies that really, I would say, warped how people thought about balanced assessment systems, or it just didn't have the impact that the authors wanted. If you go and read that 2001 publication, it's free from the National Research Council. This one is free as well, Reimagining. It wasn't that they didn't say that the heart and soul of assessment should be about supporting rich classroom learning environments and everything else from the state or everything else should be coherent with that. They did say that. But it sort of lost its you know, shine with all of the federal policy. So in this new definition, you'll see that Scott and the other authors tried to separate out what should be happening inside the classroom versus outside. So balanced assessment systems and practices are intentionally designed to provide feedback to students and information for teachers to support ambitious and equitable instructional and learning opportunities. What they didn't say in that is like, those are supposed to be assessments inside the classroom. It's like assumed. But then they do say assessments outside the classroom at the district and state level provide aggregate data to policymakers and education leaders, allowing for the monitoring of educational opportunities. That's key. Are all students being provided an equitable opportunity to learn the content standards? Teachers don't get to decide, like, sorry, my kids just aren't smart enough. I'm not teaching them grade level expectations, right? We need to have all teachers providing just-in-time instruction and giving students an opportunity to learn grade level material so those gaps don't just continue to increase. And support for high-quality instruction indirectly. Indirectly. So there are indirect effects, right? They're indirectly affecting instruction, but not directly informing instruction, through the provision of appropriate curricular resources and professional development opportunities. This is just a visualization that sometimes is helpful to capitalize on. That's a lot of words, but the key idea is the right information at the right time to the right user. That's the heart and the soul of what it means to have a balanced system of assessments, where you have inside the classroom, you have this rich learning environment. Teaching, learning, and assessment are working together. Remember the curriculum instruction assessment triangle we probably all learned in school? Oh my goodness, assessment is not out on its own, you know, wagging the dog. It is embedded and supportive of what we most want for instruction for our students. And then outside of the classroom is not then shaping what's happening inside. It's not having these pernicious effects on instruction and curriculum. Instead, it's just monitoring. It's providing this outside look that leaders can use to see, hey, do we need to continue to push and support here, add resources there, look at this curriculum here to see if it's actually aligned to our state standards, et cetera. I'm gonna go through that. Okay, last part here. We've talked about what does it mean for an assessment to be instructionally useful. We've talked about these assessment features that support it. It's not just features, it's not just design features, it's also how they're implemented. You're like, great. So what do we do with this? Well, I think low-hanging fruit here, stop asking teachers to do something instructionally useful with scaled scores, achievement levels, subcategory performance ratings, and growth scores. If anything, please just pause before you pass along those score reports to teachers and tell them, like the old Carla, do something instructionally useful with this. Educational leaders might also start to ask broader questions connected with balanced assessment systems, such as, why do we give the assessments that we do? Are leaders, like are we, are teachers using this assessment information we're collecting? Are they using all of it? If so, how are they using it? And if not, why are they not using it? How would we know our assessment system is working as intended and supplying the right information at the right time for the right users? And how could we improve our assessment system? What practical tools, resources, and guidance are freely available for use? I lead into this because the companion to Reimagining Balanced Assessment Systems was recently published, called Implementing Balanced Assessment Systems, and it's meant to be a practical guidebook for districts and schools. So we worked hard, I was one of the lead authors on this with some of my colleagues, to translate the research, Reimagining Balanced Assessment Systems volume is like 800 pages. All of us were academics. You can imagine how that turned out. I think my chapter is fantastic, but it is very theoretical and intentionally so. There's a purpose for that. But it was always imagined there would be a practical guidebook that would follow up that would say, great, that's fantastic for people who want to go read 800 pages. Could we just lower it down a little bit and say, why do we care? What would we do with this information? It's freely available, so you can download the book. I'm gonna just focus on section 3 here to see if any of these threats to balanced assessment systems resonate with you and your context, and then some practical next steps, and we will close up in just a couple minutes. So we, in the volume, talk about 9 threats. These aren't all the possible threats to balanced assessment systems in the world, but when we pulled from our own experience, when we talked to our colleagues and others who are working in districts and schools, and we said, what's really like pushing and pulling here? We started to see them under different categories. So threats to efficiency, the efficiency of the assessment system itself. How much time does it take? Too much testing overall, particularly early or later in the year. That seemed to be something many district leaders said, this is something we're noticing. Redundant assessments. We have multiple assessments doing the same things. We're not sure why, but we do. We have unused assessment results. So we have lots of data, and we're passing it around everywhere. but we're not really sure anyone's actually doing something different, making a different decision than they would have in the absence. That's the counterfactual here, right? What would you have done in the absence of that information? If you would have done the same thing, are you really using that information? Common threats to usefulness. No clear match between the assessment purpose, design, and use. Assuming all tests can inform instruction. Common threats to coherence. Inconsistency between assessments and instructional vision. This is a common one. We all have district mission and vision statements. It's like, we will develop lifelong learners who will graduate into excellence. And then we're like, now get down and take this selected response test every 5 minutes. You're like, what is happening here? Like, we just don't, we have this instructional vision, and yet our assessments are totally incoherent with what we want. It doesn't have to be that way. We don't have to let outside external influences change what happens in our classrooms. We have local control over curriculum, instruction, and assessment decisions. We don't have state control, but we have local control over everything else. Policies and politics that distort practice, grading would be a huge one there. Overemphasizing the role of summative assessment or underemphasizing the role of formative assessment. Do any of these resonate in your context? Yeah. So if you want, you can download the book, and how it's designed is we go through each threat within a page or two, explain it, some things to look for. We have vignettes from districts and states if you wanted to read that, and also a connection to more theoretical conversation in reimagining balanced assessment systems. Then at the end of every section, so the end of the efficiency section, the end of the coherence, the end of the usefulness, we talk about practical next steps of how to investigate that if it seems like an issue in your district or school. So this is the one from how to investigate threats to efficiency. And all of the tools we put in here are open resources. They're free. And so that's something that you can look at, and you can decide if that's how you want to investigate it. One of those open resources, and then I'm going to click through some of these slides quicker just to wrap up here, but in my slides, you'll see this. This is a tool we created with California. It's open access, but it's an assessment system review process. Videos, tools, all of that, completely free for use. You also have a lot of resources on the MAC website on balanced assessment systems and groups that talk about that. Definitely take advantage of those resources. And this is, I'm going to breeze through these other ones because it's just, you can find this all in the guidebook. You can look at usefulness. There's lots on formative assessment on the MAC website. There's also open access resources and tools that we have at the Center for Assessment. Everything we do is open access. We don't make money from it. It's completely free. So we give it away. You can always use that. To close, of course we want assessments to be useful, but let's just refrain from letting it slip off of our tongues, that all assessments really cannot be instructionally useful. So let's figure out which ones can be, which ones cannot be. Let's be clear about who can use what information, and really, I think, increase the coherence of our educational system and the ways in which teachers can work more effectively without all that noise happening outside. So thank you. I appreciate your time and attention today. Come to my breakout Q&A if you want to discuss more. And then as promised, here is the QR code and the tiny URL for the slides. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's have another round of applause for Carla. Thank you so much. And as Carla said, if you would like to hear more or ask her some questions, her session, her clinic will be in Petite One, and you have that opportunity to get up and close and personal with Carla. Just a couple of announcements before we begin our day. Don't forget to take your blue dots, share them with somebody who's making an impact on you over the next couple of days. Also, there are some postcards. Carla mentioned the Michigan Assessment Consortium. They're a nice sponsor of our conference. And we do have a couple of offerings that do speak to balanced assessment systems, and those are on postcards that are in the middle of your tables. Also, we're going to ask that if you are not using any of your devices, like if you have a laptop and you have a cell phone and you have your iPads or whatever, that if you have multiple and you're not using them, please turn them off so that we can save the resources in terms of the internet for our speakers and for our presenters. And we're also asking that you not set up any hotspots, because that takes away a lot of the energy from the system itself and creates problems for everybody. We're also going to ask that you do not move chairs from one room to the next. Just a couple housekeeping things. Also, we apologize, but the space here is limited, and one of the things that we have to do is vacate this room after our lunch and after keynotes pretty quickly, because they need to shut this door and then shut these walls to create space for our clinics. So getting out of here is of the essence, and you can start to do that now. And then one last thing, your name badges should be white or blue. And when we have lunch, that will be the indicator for what lunch you receive if you need a special lunch. So make sure your name badges are showing the blue or white. And thank you, and we'll see you back here for lunch.